Welcome to the New Books in Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown, and today I have the real pleasure to talk to Thomas Ogorzelak, who is the author of The Cities on the Hill, How Urban Institutions Transformed National Politics. The book was published this year by Oxford University Press, and Thomas is here with me today. Thomas, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Heath. Thanks for the invitation. I'm a great fan of the pod, and I really like the work you're doing, and I'm excited to talk to you with you about the book.
Yeah, I'm so excited to talk to you. We'll get to all the details of the book, but any book that features New York City, I just like from the start. The book is partially about New York City. It's about cities and urban politics, but it has some really interesting ways in which you come about this. Before we get to the book, why don't you just share a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago, a town called Schaumburg, which is kind of like the ultimate kind of suburb with a big mall and some highways that come together. And I've lived in a bunch of different kinds of places since then that kind of informs my research. I lived in a small town in Mississippi as an AmeriCorps teacher for a year after college. And it was in Pascagoula, Mississippi. And then I've lived in big cities ever since then, in Washington, D.C. for a couple of years, studying and researching housing policy for a national advocacy organization. And I moved to New York for graduate school, where I went to the New School in Columbia University and got a PhD in political science there at Columbia. And then I've been teaching and researching at Northwestern University, which is in Evanston, just north of Chicago. And I live in Chicago for the last 5 years. And so kind of living in different kinds of cities and this being in these kinds of places affects my worldview and also just kind of helps me understand politics a little bit better. I like to do the nuts and bolts of things. So I tried to pour all of this into the book.
Yeah,
I hope that kind of comes through.
Yeah, you poured a lot into the book. There's a lot of stuff here. We're going to talk about just a small portion of it. But let's get to what seems like one of the central arguments of the book, which is that cities and non-cities are just different, especially in what they want and what they need. You argue that cities are particularly likely to want and need public goods and to be more supportive of redistribution. Starting sort of in this theoretical area, I wonder if you'd walk us through your argument about the uniqueness of city preferences.
Sure, yeah. So one of the ways when political scientists think about politics and are trying to assess why people think the things they do about politics, is we tend to like look at nationally representative samples or speeches that people make, and often we consider them in a sort of an aspatial way. And I like to think about space and the sort of the lived context in which people spend their lives is potentially important for shaping some of those political ideologies. So the thing that we call economic liberalism or something like that seems like a set of policies that helps manage city life a little bit more effectively. And it seems like it's more important in cities than in other kinds of places to do the kinds of economic interventions that are pretty common in American politics. So as you mentioned, like public goods, makes a lot more sense to build something like an airport or a big bridge or something like that when there's in an area where there's a lot of people around to use it. You know, we had the famous Bridge to Nowhere a few years ago out in Alaska, and was going to be like a giant bridge the size of the Brooklyn Bridge for like 15 people or something like that. That didn't make that much sense. But the Brooklyn Bridge makes a lot of sense in Brooklyn when it was built between America's sort of two largest cities at the time. And like hundreds of thousands of people can use it every day. So thinking about like the different actual contexts in which some of these interventions get made seems to be an important thing. So I try to work through those relationships in terms of ideology or in terms of specific policies, in terms of like the urban or rural character of the places in which they might be portrayed. So it's not the case that one size fits all policies make a lot of sense in every different kinds of place. So working through those kinds of questions seems like an important thing to think about when we're considering American politics and polarization.
Now, this agreement that you described does not mean that cities are single-minded in their political views. And in actuality, you show that cities are quite diverse. So if this is right, how could it be that a given city like New York, there can be widely varying ideologies, but this consensus on something as important as the provision of goods? So what's that? Is this a paradox? Is this the right characterization of your take, or is it something else?
Yeah, definitely. So that's one of the things that draws me to study cities in the first place. And, you know, like when you're reading a lot about cities and in the field of urban politics, the thing that comes through isn't that cities, it's easy to govern cities or that everybody gets along and agrees on anything. It's that basically nobody agrees on everything. There's a famous book about San Francisco in which Richard De Leon talks about the idea of hyperpluralism as a way to describe cities. And it's just like there's so many interests and there's so many different kinds of people from so many different kinds of places with so many different interests. So it's hard to figure out what's sort of the right way or what's the city's interest. And so, but ultimately we do need to come to some sort of governance arrangements because cities are also kind of generate lots of governance demands. You know, there's lots of garbage. We got to clean up the garbage. We got to fix the potholes. We got to resolve social conflicts. We got to do all kinds of things. And we can't get too bogged down in this hyper-pluralism and this diversity of interests. So where I try to focus is less about sort of individuals' preferences, which is one of the places that a lot of political scientists kind of stop or focus on, look at how different individuals think about politics, and to try to characterize the governance demands of these places, and then how the governance demands will shape sort of elites' decision-making or the negotiation between elites who are ultimately going to be governing the city or coming together to like form coalitions or figure out how to do sort of power broker arrangements in order to make things work a little bit better. So yeah, I think it's a paradox. There's so much heterogeneity of interests within cities, but we do need to sort of get on with the business of governance. So it's a tough thing to figure out. And it's one of the things that I think for me makes cities interesting to study. And then also kind of provides puzzles about how cities are going to represent themselves in other venues when they have to kind of be a little bit more unified if they want to get anything.
Now, you argue that institutions in particular help to coordinate this complicated political landscape. Which institutions to you matter most to your argument? And what have they done historically to keep advocacy for cities in Washington coordinated in some way?
Sure. So when we think about, it's a really good question. When we think about the nature of how cities might represent themselves or present something like a city policy agenda, urban policy agenda in national politics, we want to think about some of the institutions that provide political order in the face of that sort of social heterogeneity. So how do you overcome that social heterogeneity? And there's two sort of classes of institutions that I focus on in the book. They're both, I refer to them as institutions of horizontal integration, where they kind of integrate the horizontal geographical space of the city into one sort of more unified political block that we'll call this the city delegation. And the two different types of institutions of horizontal integration are jurisdictional. So one's just the city boundary itself. So the idea that all of the different parts of New York City are kind of lumped together in one thing called New York City matters for politics. If Brooklyn was still its own city, it probably wouldn't get along quite as well, or it would be harder to build coalitions with Manhattan or with New York or with Queens or with Staten Island. But because they're all in New York City, it seems to make coalitions work a little bit better. So that's the city boundary. And another one is a local political party. So local political parties are often seen as, some referred to as machines or something like that, or Kings County Democratic Party or the Cook County Democratic Party. These are also different kinds of organizations, so organizational institutions of horizontal integration. They kind of bring together some of these elites and allow them to make deals across space. So one of the ways I kind of think about it in Chicago, where I live, it's a very segregated city. You know, the north side has historically been almost 100% white. The south side has been majority black for a really long time. They've all been part of both the city of Chicago and the Chicago Democratic Party for a really long time. And they're able to work out some deals to sort of overcome a little bit of that heterogeneity. It's not really perfect. And I talk about a lot about that in the book too. We have like recurrent conflicts, but I think those conflicts we're able to overcome some of those conflicts a little bit better when we've got these sort of stable patterns of governance, these institutions that kind of help people get in the same room and help try to solve problems collaboratively.
Now, when Dan Hopkins came on the podcast last month, he talked about Tip O'Neill's adage about local politics. And it seems that your book is challenging, this simple understanding that all politics are local. Your book is novel in that you are interested in city politics, but not in City Hall exactly. you shift to the national venues for much of your analysis. So in doing this, what are you able to examine about city politics, and what are the types of data that you use, and what is the time period that you study?
So I really like Dan's book, and it's funny you mentioned that. I'm also kind of working on another article, kind of an exchange with him on the other channel right now. But so I think that our books have a fair amount in common and a little bit in tension in terms of thinking about how place might matter for politics. But in my story, I'm I use data from most of the 20th century, but I focus in especially on an era between basically the 1930s and the 1960s. We call it the Long New Deal, which is kind of an era of Democratic Party dominance, when you have this kind of coalition between Southern Democrats who had been in the Democratic Party for a long time and a growing urban bloc that's in cities across the country, but especially in the industrial North. And so I look at how that coalition came together and shaped a national politics. And so one of the key things I'm looking at is how not just like how city politics work out on the ground within the streets of the city, but how they sort of transmit to supra-local politics, politics beyond the city limits. Because I think it's really important to understand how cities fit into the federal system of American governance, which kind of constrains cities. You know, cities need to do a lot of things, but they've got a lot of like limits on the things they're able to do effectively at home. So going beyond that, to going from the streets to the hills, the city on the hill, that's the intentional title of the book for that. Thinking about how cities represent themselves in national politics is kind of an innovative step, but I think it's the strategic move for cities to make if they're limited in what they can accomplish at home. They want to shape the broader context in which they're doing things. So the key part of the book is in the 1930s, when there's a shift in American politics, and we start to see cities getting together in one big coalition, and they're starting to develop advocacy groups like the U.S. Conference of Mayors to try and advance city policy and city agenda in national politics. And they're also achieving some policy goals through the New Deal and things like that, and actually deliver a lot of goods to cities and allow cities to govern themselves a little bit more effectively through this alliance, rather than try to each kind of do it on their own or as rivals with each other. They become allies instead.
And what do you find when you examine congressional roll call votes? Do members from a given city tend to vote together, controlling for all those other reasons they might vote together, you know, otherwise, such as partisanship? So do you find that the voting of House members from cities tend to travel together during this time period?
Yeah, so one of the central and kind of most surprising things I came across as I was reading the book is there's an idea that among representatives at this time, that representatives from cities represent not just their separate districts, but they represent the city as a whole and kind of form what I call a city delegation in the book. And so, I tried to dig in a little bit more closely and understand how these city delegations might work. You know, when we think about how representation typically works in American politics, you've got the district and they vote for the representative, and then the representative responds to things in the district. But city districts are totally different from each other. The north side of Chicago is kind of all white, or different collections of white working class or affluent white districts. South side, mostly black and mostly working class. And we have like a lot of heterogeneity within these cities, but the city delegations themselves, it turns out, tend to vote more cohesively than we would expect. So I can use some statistical techniques to try to tease out the effects of these institutions of horizontal integration in congressional voting. And I'm able to find that there's a substantial, substantively large effect that city boundaries seem to have, and that the strength of local institutions have, because different cities have different strengths of local institutions. You know, the Chicago machine was known to be very strong and centralized, where Mayor Daley and his predecessor had a lot of control over the actions of other people in the Chicago Democratic Party, whereas other places like New York or LA, the institutions, the party institutions are a little bit weaker and more fragmented. So we can tease out the strength of the institution, how that's associated with the cohesion of the city delegation in voting and behavior. And also we can see that even though districts are very different from each other, they're pretty cohesive. They're very cohesive, in fact, in the way they represent themselves. They're representing a city interest, not just their district interests.
You know, and much of the book is focused on New York and Chicago and a couple of other cities. I wonder if you could talk about the focus here and how far these results generalize to cities that, you know, may not be as large or as unusual in the ways that Chicago and New York are. Are your findings about sort of cities on the Hill specific to these big cities, or is it a broader phenomenon?
Mm-hmm. It's a really good question. Yeah. So when people ask about which cities I study, I say all of them. But really, I have a particular affection for New York and Chicago. And then I also they're also sort of two of the most studied cities in American urban politics research. So there's a lot of other people who have had takes on them, so that it's easy to enter into that literature and try to understand what's going on. But I'm also theoretically interested in those places, in part because New York is kind of the most urban place. In addition to being the biggest city, it's also the densest, the most heterogeneous. So it's like a model for the other cities. And it was by far kind of the leader of this urban political order, this coalition of cities that came together during this time. Fiorella LaGuardia was one of the persons who was pretty important in doing this, but the city itself was pretty important. And, you know, there's a lot of representatives from New York during this time. And Chicago as well is, I think, pretty interesting and distinctive because of the strength of that local institution. We're kind of able to see how those institutions, the organizational institution of horizontal integration, happens sort of in practice. And so we can kind of extrapolate. It's hard to tell how generalizable some of these things are. And especially partly because of the way that the historical record is set up, you know, I have to go and look in the archives and try and find correspondence between representatives and mayors to try to see whether or not they're talking to each other and trying to influence national representation. But then also we're a little bit limited by the data in order to just analyze congressional delegations from cities, because most cities don't have more than one representative in Congress. We have to have like a large enough delegation in order to be able to understand whether or not it's cohesive. And so New York and Chicago and Philadelphia and Los Angeles and maybe a couple of other cities over time are large enough to do that. It's also easier to do it early in time because the cities made up a bigger share, so the city delegations were bigger. New York and Chicago city delegations are about half as big as they were during the New Deal era. So I'm examining it during that time. So there's some limitations. Sort of some of these analyses are driven by the data, and some of them are driven by theoretical ideas about sort of who's coming up with the ideas about how to manage a city. And I think it's the city-est places, New York and Chicago, that are doing this during the time.
Yeah, the other book that I've read and the author came on the podcast was Clayton Nall's book about the development of the interstate highway system and the advantages that brought to suburban and rural areas, and the way in which that sort of happened ever since the 1940s or so. I wonder if you talk a little bit about the phenomena that you discover for cities in comparison to the politics of suburban and rural areas. What you've described sounds like it works to the benefit of representing people living in cities, but that also works into a political system where those in suburban and rural communities are seeking representation. So fit this together for us. How does this fit into a larger national picture of politics where not just cities are seeking representation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really good question. And I admire Clayton's book. I think it's a really good volume about the nature, the way that policy shapes politics and then back and forth. The nature of the urban suburban divide is a piece of the book. The thing I wanted to get into when I was taking this approach to studying city politics is really about exactly what you're asking. So thinking about how cities, it's not just how cities do politics locally, but how they go and contend with other interests and other political forces within the broader nation. And so partly one of the analytical kind of tricks, not a trick, but analytical leverage I'm able to gain is I kind of look most closely at the era before the highway program allowed this kind of dispersion of people. And some of that dispersion was probably based on people's political preferences or just general disposition towards the kind of place they wanted to live in and something like that, which we think is associated with their political and partisan views today. So before the people who took those highways out to the suburbs and created an urban-suburban polarization in these metro areas in Clayton Nall's great book, those people lived in the cities, and they were, you know, they didn't have quite as much residential choice before it was easy to get around on these highways. So thinking about kind of how the cities represented or didn't represent some of those individuals, perhaps more conservative perspectives, this is like one of the paradoxes that's in the book too, especially on questions of race and residential integration. The other thing I try to think about, and I don't deal with it that much in the book because I'm focused mostly on that long New Deal era that I was talking about, is what's going on with the suburbs? It's basically 70% of Americans live there today. If we want to understand kind of place character, we're going to need to come up with a good theory of the suburbs. And I think it's really hard because so the suburbs are growing and they're growing quickly, but they're also the kind of in-between space. They're in-between in terms of their partisanship now. Rural areas tend to be more Republican and suburban areas in between, and then cities tend to be more Democratic. And then they're also kind of in between and so heterogeneous and varied in terms of their actual kind of place character. So the suburbs of New York, you go up to like Yonkers, we might call Newark a suburb of New York now. There's places that are like really kind of urban in their character, but they're not cities in terms of being really big places that combine a lot of different kinds of individuals into a common political community that's kind of big on the national scale. And then you go out west and suburbs are, you know, huge and sprawling and completely car-based. And then there's all kinds of other kinds of suburbs in between. The suburbs are getting more and more complex. And if we want to understand place, we're going to have to like look more closely at them and think about that. One thing I would say is that suburban politics is kind of premised on the idea of political fragmentation. It's kind of the opposite of these institutions of horizontal integration. You look at the map of Chicagoland, we've got Chicago right in the middle, and then you've got this map of the suburbs where it's just little towns that are basically the size of Chicago neighborhoods, but each one has its own sort of political community that it's in, and it arranges its own politics. And so it's premised around the idea of sort of walls between places rather than bridges across different communities. So I think that's an important thing to think about in terms of the way that place might filter up into national politics. It would be built less on sort of figuring out how to overcome some of these social and political fragmentations for governance, and maybe it might make it a little bit more challenging.
Yeah, the book that you've been hearing about, The Cities on the Hill, How Urban Institutions Transformed National Politics, is published this year by Oxford University Press. You've been hearing from Thomas Orgazolak. Thomas, thank you very much for your time, and thank you very much for the book.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Heath. It's great to talk to you.